General session. It's our pro-con debate with audience response. The audience response to me is the least important part of it. I want discussion. People sitting in the room pressing the button without any discussions are a waste of time. So we're going to start off with our pro, Michael J. Reardon. In moderate risk patients, TAVR is economically feasible. Let's make this interactive, fun, and let's have a little controversy and some fighting, please.
Well, this is kind of strange to have a surgeon presenting the pro to this, but that's what I have, and I'm actually interested in this. I'm a little nervous going first. I'm going to debate a guy who I've already checked out, and I've been told he's one of the smartest administrators out there. He's probably going to be CEO of the entire Emory system at some point, and I'm a country surgeon from Texas, so we'll see how this goes. So, why do people start TAVR service lines? There's a lot of reasons. The pros are it's part of the core mission of a multidisciplinary advanced valve program. It's a strategic link to valve surgery. Aortic valve replacement is very profitable for hospitals. We talk about upstream and downstream activity, relatively minor, but, you need to understand that. Your hospital will tell you there's no upstream and downstream activity because they don't like you to know when you make money. And the halo effect, it's real, but it's hard to quantify. We'll talk about that. A little bit of what are the downsides as we go through the debate. Well, it can be unprofitable on its own, depending particularly on where your hospital is and how you get paid. It's very resource intensive, and so, my administrators love it if there's an empty bed and we're putting in somebody who's a non-operable patient to be treated. But if the beds are full and I'm taking up a bed that could go to an AVR, they're less enthused about that. And then there are, unfortunately, few options to improve the financials by hospitals or physicians, but we'll talk about that as we go through the debate. So we're talking about moderate risk people. So let's talk a little bit about what moderate risk is, how we define that, and what do we really mean by economically feasible. So in surgery, we look at people as low risk, moderate risk, high risk, and extreme risk, or inoperable. When you look at the partner B, they called them inoperable. When we started CoreValve, we decided, well, there really is nobody that's inoperable. We can operate on anybody, just some people we shouldn't operate on, and they're extreme risk. So both in the partner trial and the CoreValve trial, the extreme risk or the non-operable cohort was defined as somebody that has a 50% risk of death or irreversible morbidity at 30 days. And these are people that none of us want to operate on. And then the high risk were defined as people that had a risk of operative mortality of 15% or above at 30 days. And that was defined as an STS of 10 or above because of Todd Dewey's work showing that STS in this patient cohort tended to underestimate the risk. In fact, if you look at the DECIDE-AVR trial, which looked at 146 people over 65 having isolated AVRs, if your STS was 10 in the community, your mortality was 17%. Moderate risk we've defined both for partner 2A and for SIRTAVI is an STS of 4 to 10, although I found out recently partner 2A got to go below that, and I'm asking the FDA to let us go below it in SIRTAVI. But it represents about 25% of the people out there. So we're talking about a fairly large part of the group that are out there. And low risk is about 65%. And right now, nobody's banging on the low risk door. But I hate to tell you this, just wait. We're seeing it come in Europe already. So there are a number of ways of looking at economic viability. One is to look at the cost per quality of your life gain. And the other one is to look at the hospital balance sheet. These are two separate things. If you look at the partner B results or the inoperable arm, which only had a transfemoral arm to it, and you look at the cost. Now, if you look at this graph, going up on the y-axis is the cost. Going across on the x-axis is either the quality years of life gained or lost. And so you see our data dots. We see what it costs to gain a quality year of life. And so it's about $50,000 per quality year of life gained. Typically, $100,000 per quality year of life is kind of the cutoff that society tends to use to say we're not going to go above that. So we're below that. But why doesn't TAVR save more money in these inoperable patients? Well, the problem is the control patients die too quickly. If you remember from partner B, the mortality in the control arm, the medical arm, was over 50% at 1 year. These people are dying at a rate of 4% per month under medical treatment. And the other problem is that these are pretty sick people. They're people who are not going to touch, so keeping a TAVR patient alive in this group was pretty difficult. But it meets the criteria for what people in society would say is reasonable. So now let's go to partner A, which looked at people randomized to surgery. These are the people that had a operative risk estimated to be 15% or above, kind of the top 10% of what we're seeing as surgeons right now. And the cost actually went down for TAVR. And so it puts us well below $50,000 per year quality of life. So what are the key insights from that? Well, TAVR actually reduced the length of stay by 6 days versus aortic valve replacement. And that can be dangerous, too, depending on when you send them home and if you send them straight to home or with care. And that transfemoral TAVR resulted in improved early quality of life. Not a surprise. If I put a little poke in your groin and get rid of your aortic stenosis, you recover quicker than if I put any kind of cut on you, whether it be minimally invasive or full sternotomy. But the other part of Partner A was they allowed a transapical access. And what happened in transapical? Well, it actually cost more, and your quality of life went down. And so you failed the $50,000 or even the $100,000 quality of life. So what were the key insights from that? Transapical TAVR did not substantially reduce the length of stay. It was 14 versus 16 days. And the early and midterm quality of life was slightly worse than surgery. Now, in Partner, both the surgery and TAVR improved your quality of life by 24 points on the Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Scale. Anything over 20 is considered a huge improvement. So what happened is that, at least for transfemoral, we knew that this would work well. And so we got it approved for both high risk and extreme risk. And so if you look at it against other things that are out there, just looking at kind of quality of life years, it cost about $50,000 per quality life year. So compared to other things we're already doing, LVAD is destination therapy, over $250,000. PCI for stable coronary disease, $150,000 over. Why? Because these people aren't dying anyway, and we're not making them a lot of them feel better, so you have to spend a lot to get them to feel better. It's about what it costs for atrial fib ablation. It's about what it cost us for giving somebody dabigatran for AFib. So it's in a very reasonable range. Now, what we know is that the longer you live, the more cost-effective it's going to become, because you live longer with your improved symptoms, because we know we're going to get rid of your aortic stenosis. So how does that relate to moderate risk? Well, moderate risk is something that is going to come after high and extreme. High and extreme is already accepted. It's accepted in this country. There's a commercially available valve. We just presented the core valve extreme risk data at TCT on Tuesday, and the FDA is going to let us go forward without a panel. So the die is cast here. We know that's been accepted. Moderate risk patients, we really don't know. We're looking at that in Partner 2A and Certavi right now, but we know they're less sick. And these less sick people are going to live longer. And that should improve the cost effectiveness. So we're pretty sure at the end of Partner A and Partner B, we're going to be able to show quality of life improvement that will be accepted by society. But how about the hospital balance sheet? Well, we got passed over by Edwards for the Partner trial. We were none too happy about that. But we realized we weren't organized very well. So we started a valve clinic in late 2009 to make our site attractive as a TAVR study site for the next valve that would come down the pike. This is a standalone clinic that's in addition to the pre-existing clinics, so this is all additional business. And this is what's happened to our valve clinic since we started it. You know, it's pretty much doubled every year. It's a little behind this year. But if you can see in the upper right-hand corner, annualized for 2013, we'll have a 158 identified new patient visits. And, you know, the problem with this is that because a lot of these are people that are getting TAVR and they're getting constant follow-ups, you can also see there's 461 established visits. So this thing does tend to become a little bit of a monster. But it's clearly grown, and it's clearly improving the number of people that we see as a valve program. Now, this is from the Cardiovascular Roundtable, and they estimated that for every 10 patients you screen, you'll get one TAVR out of that. You'll get about 3 aortic valves. We've screened over 350 patients right now. All those people get a variety of things, and their question is, have they improved my hospital's bottom line? We'll kind of go through this. This is our TAVR volume and an annualized 213. I actually thought I'd be far above this. The thing that's holding my program back right now is not the number of patients out there, but the number of research personnel I need to take care of these people and follow the data. These are hugely data-intensive people, and if you're doing commercial, you need to put them in the TVT group, and if you don't put them in the TVD group, you won't get paid, so you're going to have to hire somebody to do that. And, you know, I expect this is going to go up, but I've been building the research infrastructure just to support the program. So what is the economic impact of a TAVR program on the hospital's balance sheet? Well, let's look at what hospitals talk about. We all know that you get paid something for this. You get revenue. And then you take that revenue and you deduct the direct cost, what it costs for the valve, to be in the operating room, the actual things associated with that procedure. And that is going to that's going to contribute to the overhead of the hospital, and that's your contribution margin. A lot of doctors think that's how much money the hospital makes. That's not the money the hospital makes. to figure the money the hospital makes, you have to add in any indirect revenue the lawsuit settles, like that your hospital gets. This is minor stuff. And then you have to deduct the indirect costs, what it costs to keep the lights on, malpractice, your administrators, and that gives you your hospital gain loss, the funds that are available for investment, expansion, replacement, upgrades, and losses to be subsidized. So these are case contribution margins. That's typical things we see as people that take care of cardiovascular disease. And the higher up you go, in balloon size, the more contribution margin you see the hospital. Look at aortic valve, look at valve surgery. Valve surgery is a huge contributor to the contribution margin of the hospital. Look at TAVR down there. It's far smaller. And if you look at the different DRGs, they all contribute at different levels. So remember, there's several DRGs that we use. We use 2, 16, 17, and 18, which are valve disease with a cardiac cath that start off with major complications, with complications, and no complications. And then we have 2, 19, 20, and 21, which are the same thing without cath, which in TAVR world is what we're seeing. They're getting cath beforehand, and so we're moving down to things that have lesser base weight. Now, the other thing I want you to look at is look at the global length of stay, because that's an important number that you need to remember as we go forward. So if I look at what happened with my valve clinic, we saw a total of 589 new patients between 2010 and August of 2013. You see the total charges were about $6.5 million. As is typical, what we got paid was $1.2 million for all those charges, and the net collections per patient were about $2,178. These are the new physician referrals, identified new physician referrals that people we could not tag as referring to us before between 2012 and 2013. So it's clearly broadened our base of referrals. So how about my hospital? What's going on with my hospital? Well, we have to look at upstream and downstream revenue. Upstream revenue is what's done before your procedure. What things happen to your patient the hospital can make money on before you operate them. There's the procedure itself, and then there's downstream revenue. What gets done after the procedure? And our contribution margin is positive in all of those. And in fact, in the cases that we looked at before I cut the date off, we had a contribution margin of over $2.2 million. And these are the contribution margins that you see on the right based on different DRGs that my hospital sees. I went back and I looked at upstream revenue and downstream revenue, and I was forced to look at sheets like this. Think sheets that Dane understands, and I looked at it and my eyes just glazed over. And we looked at all these things and what people were getting, and that's how we came up with this data. Now, the other thing that's important, this is a paper that was put up by Chris Malarcy, who's one of my old residents, and what he showed at his institution, as soon as they had a TAVR program going, the number of people with untreated aortic valve disease fell. Why? Because they all came in to be evaluated, and a lot of them went to surgery. And we've seen this in Europe, and we've seen it at my place, too, that there is at least an early initial increase in your surgical valves. Okay. This is what happened in our halo effect. When we started our TAVR program, these are my annualized valves as they've gone up. And here's kind of the meat of this. If you look at the contribution margin, which is the spot between what it costs to get an average TAVR and a surgical out and the payment, here's what it is. We can increase that by decreasing the length of stay, saves us about $3,000. We can do that by putting the valve in half. Core valve is going to be approved soon. Once we get a third valve, I think we'll actually get the manufacturers to go down. And you can see the contribution margins come closer. If we combine that with a decreased length of stay, the contribution margins become equal. We can also do it by getting paid more. Sounds nice, unlikely to happen. We can also do it by looking at what the indirect costs are. So how do you decrease indirect costs to increase your hospital profit or loss? I don't know, maybe we could pay our administrators less. So the recommendations are audit your program, know your coders, understand your stay and length of stay, understand the transfer penalty. If you send somebody home before the geometric length of stay and you send them to home health care, you lose money. Track and analyze your cost. Obtain the appropriate reimbursement DRG. My conclusions are TAVR for extreme and high risk is already accepted and established. An infrastructure for a TAVR program already will be built and largely a fixed cost. Patients seek out TAVR programs. Moderate risk cases are already being done in Europe. And the U.S. will follow up Partner 2A and Certavi have positive results. For moderate risk cases to be economically feasible, TAVR valve costs must approach surgical valve costs and or length of stay and hospital costs must decrease in TAVR to make up for the difference in valve costs. I think these things will happen. This, unfortunately, is what our average TAVR case looks like. Two heart surgeons, four cardiologists, can't get in the room. We're not making any money for this as surgeons, but we do it because we love it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. That was excellent. Dane Peterson, who I understand is the brains behind running Emory Hospital, is next, and he's either going to tell us that the doctors spend too much money, or he's going to hire Mike Reardon as a consultant.
Yeah, there you go. I think it'll be the latter. No, really, thanks very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here, and it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of fun. Dr. Reardon had a lot of really good information there, and it's not incorrect. It's just a little different perspective, I think. So let's take a look. This is how I feel. So if you think it's, you know, the country doctor thing, Dr. Reardon, you put a CEO in front of a bunch of surgeons around technology advances, and I've got a knife, you got guns, and so you're not going to see a lot of medical jargon come out of my mouth. I am going to try to give you a perspective around a hospital looking at it and saying, how do we make these kind of decisions and work with our surgeons to do it right the first time. So here's what we're talking about. A lot of times I feel like when I get into discussions with physicians and we have disagreements, a lot of it ends up being because we're talking about different things. So I really want to be very clear about what I'm trying to understand and try to communicate. The economics around hospitals and healthcare systems. So both Dr. Reardon and I had the same perspective there. We're trying to make this debate, this decision around what it feels like to be a hospital or healthcare system, not from society as a whole, because things can be different that way. Obviously, feasibility in only moderate risk patients. You know, a lot of the data we have right now is on high risk or inoperable. That's very, some of the data there is pretty clear. Moderate risk, as we talked about, Sirtavi and Partner 2, it's just not there yet. This is what we're not talking about. The feasibility on the moral ethical arguments, or even an argument around surrounding the value of additional research. We're very bullish on the research at Emory, looking forward to answering some of these questions that we don't have answered right now. And I think right now that the data is going to show that the con on this argument is weighing heavily. So I wanted to share two perspectives, and it kind of goes right through this way, that hospitals and healthcare systems are looking at these decisions in a different way. Before the last 10, 15, 20, 30 years, whatever it is, as we've all grown up in healthcare, we've been looking at it from a World A perspective. This World A around fee-for-service, volume potentially over value, but we don't want to do invaluable things, but more on the idea of how much profit can I make, not necessarily how much value can I provide. That's changing. At Emory, we call the Cinderella parable. It's the idea that we do not want to be left at the ball at 12 o'clock still hanging on to old fee-for-service thought processes. And we have to make the changes, this transition, as we go through this membrane into more of a value-based population health management idea. So this idea now, when you think about it, so hospital administrators talking about value, not necessarily just profits and contribution margin, those things, because the quality aspect is key. So here's what it looks like for us. The value proposition, and it's the same as any industry. I came from the automotive industry before healthcare. It's the same as automotive. Quality over cost will define value. So we're going to walk through the numerator and denominator on this for moderate risk patients and try to figure out if we think that value is going up for TAVR versus surgical AVR or going down. For TAVR to be economically feasible in moderate or even high risk patients, it needs to match or increase value over surgical. And guys, as you do surgical AVR better and better every year, you're raising the bar on TAVR every year from a quality perspective. So the numerator, moderate risk TAVR outcomes, obviously we don't have them yet. So the Sirtavi and the Partner 2 trials are just going on. The endpoints, I will share this with you, and I'm not a researcher, but as I understood the non-inferiority complex, that idea, we need superiority for TAVR over SAVR when we talk about the idea of the quality aspects of it. Obviously, and you guys know very well the stroke and all cause mortality for 2 years. We're not going to know this data for another couple years. Now, individual centers will have data, and we use it every day with Vino and Vasilis. Did try to take a look at some surrogate data, though, because at the end of the day, I don't want to just say we don't know, so I got to say no. So took a look, Moat and colleagues, when we talk about stroke, it remains a major concern, represents an obstacle to application of TAVI in lower risk patients. That's on the numerator side. If stroke still remains high, that means the cost has to be significantly lower to be economically feasible. Outcomes, Dr. Thorani and colleagues from our organization, comparisons of less invasive techniques for AVR should rely on outcomes based in modern era, not 10, 15 years ago. Again, the surgeons in this room and back wherever you came from are doing better and better surgical AVR, again, raising the bar for TAVR when it comes from a quality perspective. Finally, on the numerator side is just, you know, excellent results in AVR expected over the age of 80. I know this is not moderate risk. I'm not trying to share that. I'm just trying to use surrogate data to figure out, can I try to explain the numerator side of the value equation? Recent advances, though, every year SAVR raises the bar. So we got to figure out, and that's why I'm so excited about Certavi as well as Partner 2, is maybe we can answer some of these questions and prove that TAVR is more efficacious. So let's switch to denominator. This is data from Emory, from both our hospitals that do the work. And this is just from the past about year and a half. And just so you know, the surgical AVRs, those are the kind of isolated surgical. So no CABG, nothing else with, you know, going on. Trying to look at apples to apples as much as possible. You will see the length of stay reduction, just like Dr. Reardon mentioned. We do have shorter length of stay with Partner 2 trials. You can see there, you know, the cost aspects. You know, again, I'm looking quality over cost, not looking at reimbursement, looking at cost, because it's about value going forward, not about how much money I can make on each individual patient. So the cost aspect is $16,000 less for all of Partner 2 over our surgical AVRs. Now, this is not apples to apples, though, because as we know, Partner 2 has both inoperable, you know, higher risk patients as well as the moderate risk. So I try to do a little bit on that spreadsheet that Dr. Reardon mentioned. I did take a peek at the same kind of spreadsheet. It's great that they're in Texas and in Georgia. And so what I did is I took a look at the kind of the middle part of both. So I took at the median length of stays and did plus minus 2 days. Is it right? I don't know. It's at least closer, I think. So it gets to the idea of what is more moderate risk when it comes to surgical as well as the Partner 2 trial. Again, is it wrong? Yes, it is. Is it informative? I hope so. This shows the actual costs are about $18,000 difference. Guys, I tell you, I think if I took a look at any little subset of SAVR versus TAVR, Partner 2 trials, I think I would come up with the exact same $15,000 to $20,000 difference. So within that realm, there are moderate risk to moderate risk patients. The TAVR is more expensive. And the data is just not there yet to say that it's more higher quality. Now, to be fair, there is a study that's been published out there on the idea of the high risk. You know, is it cost effective for high risk patients? And so took a look at this. And the study showed, yes, it is cost effective in the same way with the quality data. I think this is one of the reports that maybe Dr. Reardon had referenced. But it was only for transfemoral. It was not for transapical, just like Dr. Reardon said. It was a cumulative 12-month cost, which is good. Here's the issue, though. It took a look at it from the healthcare, the U.S. In general, not from a healthcare perspective. So here's my problem with this study. From a healthcare perspective, I'm not going to argue the data of the research. I'm sure it's very, very good. From a hospital perspective, by looking at solely the U.S., really what we're saying is we're okay to change and make the changes today. Hospital profits down. Industry up. It's kind of like a redistribution of the profits when we take a look at a healthcare perspective instead of a hospital perspective. So that's why I took the hospital perspective. I don't know. Okay. So this is my last one. So given that TAVR is more expensive to hospitals, healthcare systems, has not been shown to higher quality right in moderate risk patients, right now it's clear that it's not economically feasible. But Dr. Reardon is great. Thanks.
Thank you. So we're working very hard to try to get back on time. We're going to shave 5 to 7 minutes off the next talk. That gives us about 3 to 5 minutes to discuss this. So let's open it up. We're going to stop. We're not going to do the audience questions. They're not helpful. Let's rather get a discussion from the podium, or excuse me, from the floor. Please do. Come on up and say anything controversial, and hopefully someone's going to ask you some questions.
So listen, I admit that Dane's a lot smarter than I am. But remember, this debate was, can it be economically feasible, not is it economically feasible? And, you know, we're talking about a mature specialty, surgical aortic valve replacement, 60 years of experience, versus something that's been here for 10 years. Put up Neil Moat's quote about stroke. You know, that was a concern after the partner, Hartzell Schaff, wrote a little editorial. You know, but if you look at the core valve extremist data just presented at TCT, our 30-day stroke rate was 2.4%, and at 1 year it was 4.5% for major strokes. Anything over a rank and two, that was half of the partner data in the same group of people. If you look at the continued access to that, it dropped from 2.4 at 1 month to 1.8. So these things are all being shaved off. The moderate paravalvular leak, the thing that keeps people sick, was dropped down at 1 year to 4.5%. So the problem is it economically feasible today? Probably not. Do we have the data to use it today? No, we don't. We need these randomized trials. Is it going to be? Yeah, you drop your valve in half and your numbers match. And when we get a third valve on there, it's going
to
happen.
But is our health care going to afford us to get there? Go ahead.
So one question. That was a great debate. Thank you for both of you to doing this. Here's the big question. I think it comes down to, you know, the same people doing SAVR are doing TAVR. So it's the same group of people. We're working hard. We're not keeping SAVR patients an extra 4 days in the hospital and sending the TAVR home early because we want to do it that way. I think it comes down to the cost of the valve. I think that when we look at $25,000 valve, which it is for the study valve, we're actually doing pretty good. When you look at a $32,000 valve, we're all of a sudden ain't doing very good. So the question is how do we as a healthcare system, Dane, go to industry and say, you're going to bankrupt our system, or you're not going to expand to other smaller centers that are going to be able to do this. You're not going to be able to penetrate very high into this. Do we have 10, 15, 20 centers, 100 centers say, we refuse to do your procedure. We can't do your procedure because not only are we not viable, we're not profitable. Forget the profitable part. We're not going to be viable anymore.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, sorry for not being controversial. I actually, Dr. Reardon, I would not bank against this team around the idea of can. You know, can it ever be? Absolutely it can be, but it's going to take a lot of work to get there on quality as well as cost. To your question, Dr. Thorani, we're talking the valves are 5-6 times more expensive. The length of stay reductions that would be required, you'd have to go in the negatives. So the valve cost absolutely is driving my perspective around short-term, is it economically feasible, versus longer-term thinking around can it be? It's the cost of the valve because the length of stay is lower, which means the surgeons and staff are doing a great job with that. The cost of the valve is a problem. How we do that is through competition, and so that's why it's important to have SirTavi and Partner2 and all the rest of them that are going on is get them all out there and work very, very hard for competition. And I look forward, as we do every day, I look forward to working with surgeons with that.
One last quick question with an abbreviated, more direct answer.
So highly entertaining, excellent debate. Now, where the rubber hits the road is to shorten Vinod's question. In the lower volume centers around the country, where there's still a vast number of TAVRs being performed, at least starting to. Not like Emory, where you're doing more TAVRs, I saw, than surgical AVRs, which is incredible, and maybe suspect. But in the lower volume, are we going to hit a threshold from SirTavi results in the moderate risk group where we will not be economically feasible? Do you think there's going to be a number where, with SirTavi in the moderate risk group, that you just will not be able to be economically viable at all, regardless of what price the TAVR device comes down to? Do you think we're going to hit that point?
No.
Short answer.
Thank you.
Dane?
All right. Thank you very much. We have to move ahead. Thank you. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce someone who really doesn't need any introduction. I'm just going to say, here's Chitwood. Please remember to visit the exhibit at our break. Please remember our exhibitors, and we're getting more and more crunched for money. Without them, we don't have this meeting. Please spend time over in the exhibit hall. Thank you. Randy?